Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Johannes Streffler, Senior Vice President of Clinical Development at Lundbeck at the 2025 AES Annual Meeting to discuss the Phase 1-2 PACIFIC trial data of bexicaserin in patients with developmental epileptic encephalopathies. Throughout the discussion, Streffler outlined the scientific rationale for studying DEEs as a unified population, some of the key efficacy outcomes from the study, as well as the safety and tolerability seen in the expanded access follow-up. Furthermore, he spoke on the highly selective mechanism of bexicaserin and how Lundbeck's broader strategy in rarer neurological disorders aims to de-risk development early. Let's dive in.
The PACIFIC trial is first of its kind study of DEE. So DEE as a concept has been developed because there is a huge unmet need for that population of developmental encephalopathies and epilepsies. These are kids where today we have no drugs developed, and PACIFIC was the first time that we have an overall group of them together in one trial. We as well studied in that LGS and Dravet syndrome, which in the broader sense are part of that DEE definition. And it was very successful in the sense that we found a broad activity across all the patients we looked at, and we've seen the 60% countable motor seizure reduction that you already had discussed earlier with Ingrid Scheffer, and where we are very amazed of seeing it. Now, what we then did, obviously, in this trial, we then offered an open label extension, right? The initial period is only about 3 months, but then we want to give patients the opportunity for longer treatment. So we offered an open label extension for 1 year, and we were very positive in the sense that participations stayed with us. So more or less everybody who entered the open label, 41, as well completed the open label after 1 year, 38, which is amazing if you look at this group of patients which are severely impaired by their disease and where it's not easy to participate in clinical trials. So we're very happy about seeing that engagement in the trial, not only by the patients, but as well by the community.
Yeah, unfortunately, this has been an area that has been tough to crack, to say the least.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen a little bit of progress. We've seen a lot more attention towards this group, at least over the last couple of years, but unfortunately just haven't seen a lot of the therapeutic progress come to that. And so talk a little bit more about, before we go into more of the details of the actual study again, focus a little bit more on this specific group. Why is it such a challenge to actually study these patients themselves and keep them on trial for so long?
So we have to realize that it is a heterogeneous group, which you can look at both from a syndromal, but as well from a origin type. So what is the etiology, how they get into the seizure syndrome? What is the etiology that gives their encephalopathy? These are often young children, very vulnerable. Patients' parents are very anxious to get the right thing for them, do the right thing. So we are in a vulnerable, severely impaired population. We want to do something safe and effective for them. So clinical trials is not necessarily the obvious choice. Why do they think there is an importance? Because we have yet not developed any treatment for this group. Till today, there is no treatment that goes into the overall group. For Dravet syndrome, Lennox-Gastaut, these are the bigger groups within it. We have solutions and have some offerings, but not for all the different groups within it. And this was the first time that we could study it. But it still is a very vulnerable and severely impaired population. That's why clinical trials are not obvious. As well, the definition, and this was a very close collaboration with the scientific field, how you now define a trial entry. Because as you know, for clinical trials, we want to have a very clear definition who's entering it. It cannot be anybody who wants to participate, come. No, it has to be a very clear inclusion criteria. And we work closely with the academic leaders that have defined this group to make sure we have the right definition for the trial. As we're continuing this now into our Phase 3 program.
Yeah, I mean, like you said before, actually making sure that we're getting the right patients into the trials is an important thing to say, yep, at least. And this is a group, as we kind of talked about it before, we're starting to understand more about some of the biology of these patients. And it's been awesome that we've been including some of the DEEs outside of, like you mentioned, Dravet and LGS has kind of been the big dogs, I guess, that have taken a lot of the attention, but some of these other DEEs are starting to pay a little bit more attention to over the last couple of years. Johannes, you obviously talked a little bit about some of the efficacy data that you mentioned before. So go into a little bit more detail on just the data that was presented as a whole here at AES and any notable findings that stand out from a clinical perspective.
Absolutely. So you have discussed earlier the initial phase 1b/2a, where we've seen a very quick onset of effect. There's a first measurable time point after 2 weeks. We already see it starting and then going into about 60% on the overall countable motor seizures. We are amazed to see that we see this efficacy continued through the complete open label extension for 1 year. So during the 1 year where we have a very good retention of patients, so it's not a selection of the best that can complete it, it's more or less everybody going into the open label continued this efficacy, and we see the same mean 60%, about 60% reduction of countable motor seizures. I think this is really good. Other important thing, when you go into a group that has a lot of different anti-seizure medications, is vulnerable, we have not identified any significant safety signal today. So these patients tolerate it very well. And that is as well a testament why you have the good retention, but seemingly patients and families do believe this is the right choice for them. Otherwise, they would not stick with us for another year. So these are critical points for us, and we're really happy to have those data. Now, there is another interesting piece that we are starting to talk about. After the 1 year, we offer an EAP. And we see now up to 48 months for individual patients' treatment within the EAP, total expansion of the duration. So we have a very long treatment duration for some patients. We have a safe option for patients, and we have a very successful option for patients. That's what makes me very enthusiastic.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Streffler to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, prior to the holiday break, Contineum announced negative data from its Phase 2 proof-of-concept VISTA trial testing PIPE-307 as a remyelinating agent for relapsing multiple sclerosis. All told, the drug failed to meet its primary endpoint of change in binocular 2.5% low-contrast letter acuity over a 30-week trial period. Weeks later, newly published data from a Phase 2 trial showed that semaglutide, or Ozempic, did not lead to improved functional recovery in patients with large vessel occlusion. However, an exploratory analysis of the study revealed more sustained neurological improvement among those who did not receive intravenous thrombolysis. Otherwise known as the Gallup study, investigators noted that these preliminary findings should be replicated in a larger Phase 3 trial. And lastly, on January 5th, the FDA approved Skinko Pharm's Gladimer acetate injection as a treatment for relapsing multiple sclerosis, making it the first complex injectable generic approval for this therapy. This newly approved version is a non-biological complex drug generic, meaning it has the same active, route, and typical strengths of traditional GA, mirroring the Copaxone label. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Streffler.
No, it's awesome, especially, you know, early on. I think, you know, phase 1, 2, sometimes everybody's just looking for, obviously safety is important to say at least, but they like to see those efficacy endpoints as well. That's why we have confidence to bring it into the next level per se and things of that sort. So let's kind of take a little bit of a step back here and talk about the drug itself more. So provide a little bit of a more of an overview of this actual therapy, how it operates, the mechanism of action, and why it might be different than what we have on market right now.
What we see in bexicaserin is a highly selective drug. So while often drugs target a lot of different receptors and a lot of, let's say, not so specific, we see with bexicaserin a highly selective 5-HT2C targeting drug. This is a mechanism where we in principle understand that it will work for seizures, but the good profile as well in our belief is part of why it's so well safe and tolerated. What we as well see with it, due to the unique metabolism of the drug, we have very little drug-drug interaction. So within Pacific, we have not seen any relevant interaction with the ASMs given. And we have to realize that this is a group that has 3, 4, 5, 6 other ASMs in parallel. We have not seen that. So this is another point where we see a safe, well-tolerate, very effective drug that will be relatively easy in use for the practitioners because they don't have to take a lot of caution with other medications. If this is continued and we are obviously doing all the right studies to demonstrate that, then we hope to have a very friendly drug for the patient and for the physician that provides great efficacy in a new population.
Well, I think that's a really important point. Obviously, these patients, like you mentioned, typically on 3 to 4 to 5 medications sometimes at times, and sometimes they don't even work still for these patients, and they're very inconsistent and things of that sort. So I think not having it interfere too much with other things, I think, is a big deal. I think people like to kind of see that. Johannes, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. Last question for you. Can you also just talk a little bit more on a broad perspective for Lundbeck itself? Provide the clinical community some insights as to how Lundbeck's broader strategy in rare neurological disorders, including epileptic conditions like DEEs. Just talk a little bit about what the company is doing and mission and goals and things of that sort.
As you're aware, we are on a focused innovator strategy. We have a very strong neuropsychiatry legacy. We are working closely with the neurology community in neurospeciality, for instance, like our migraine prevention approaches. And this is very nicely complementing with NeuroRare. NeuroRare is a unique opportunity due to the better understanding of the biology. So this will help us to go into well-defined populations where we can early de-risk. And for instance, for our current 2 phase 3 programs, both the bexicaserin in the DEE, but as well in our MSA program, we are able to target very well-defined populations, de-risk them early, and then develop them into a well-defined late-stage program. That leads to the fact that we can target different indications in a very well understood way, and that is what we want to do. De-risk early, then go well-defined into areas where there's a high unmet medical need for patients, and the community is willing and looking forward to work with us on developing something.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.